January 1848 would prove to be a life-changing day for James W. Marshall. He was hired by Johann Sutter to build a sawmill on the American River near Coloma, California. He was examining the waterway below the sawmill and noticed shiny flecks in the water. Curious, he walked in, reached down to the bottom, and pulled out two pieces of shiny rocks. He carefully examined them. One rock was brittle and bright, and it turned out to be iron. The other rock was gold and bright, yet malleable. He tried to break the rock, but it just beat into different shapes. He gathered more rocks and showed them to another worker. When asked what it was, Marshall replied, "Gold. I know it to be nothing else." This discovery was the beginning of the California Gold Rush.
Welcome to Meridians.
Welcome back to Meridians. I'm Charlie Noble. The past 2 weeks I've spent talking about Joshua Slocum and his family and all their adventures at sea. And Slocum visited so many places that I could have easily bridged today's episode to pretty much anywhere on Earth that he visited. But one of the key locations in Slocum's story would be California, and in particular San Francisco. San Francisco. Added to that, Slocum's own wife had moved to California partly because of the gold rush. So today, I want to take a second, just today specifically, I want to take a quick second to review how the show has gotten where we are, making connections from one episode to the other. So I actually started bridging the episodes together around episode 7, whereas before that, it was everything within the episode was bridged together. So really, it kind of starts from the episode 7 from French Revolution, from the French Revolution to the breakthrough of electricity. And then from there, I wrote about Benjamin Franklin. Then Franklin led to London and the London fires and the British monarchy, which led to the Royal African Company, which was down in Africa, of course, which led to learning about the Asante Nation. And then to the founding of Freetown in Sierra Leone, which actually strangely led us to Nova Scotia, which is where Joshua Slocum is from, who married a woman whose family had come to California as part of the Gold Rush. And that's where we're at. And we'll have to wait to the end of the episode to find out where we go from here. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool where it looks like it's going. And I'm really interested in the character for next week. But for this week, today is a story about FOMO, the fear of missing out. I see it all the time. It's in the parking lots with people unable to drive past a parking spot that's just so good. There's brake lights and they got to get that spot. So they sit there and wait because they can't miss out on that parking spot, you know? And you see it in the public. You just see it all the time in public. People want to be winners, it seems. Any small win will do even. But I think the question is it really just that they want to be winners, or is it that you just don't want to be a loser? They don't want to miss out. Oh man, I didn't get that parking spot. Dang it. That lady got into the short line ahead of me. I've been standing here like an idiot. Oh man, Taylor Swift is in town. All my friends are going to see her. Pick your favorite artist, okay? So that's what I'm getting at today. And it'll be kind of obvious throughout this story that one group of people just did not fare as well, and it'd probably surprise you exactly which. So the other half of today's story will be about some people who just seem to stumble over success after success, and they came out very well, and that'd be about the Murphy brothers, two pioneering men who seemed to have luck on their side with anything they did. Okay, now let's talk about James W. Marshall some more from the opening. And let's just dial it back to 1844. This is a time when a lot of people are arriving by wagon train in the western United States. So James W. Marshall arrived in Oregon in 1844 as part of one of these wagon trains. And so he did some carpentry in Oregon's Willamette Valley for a year, and then he kind of just wandered south into California. Real adventuring spirit, I'll give him credit for that. And it was there that he first met Johann Sutter. And recognizing Marshall's skills as a craftsman, Sutter hired him to make tools, furniture, spinning wheels, looms, basically anything that can be made and sold from wood. And then in 1846, that's when Marshall got involved in the Mexican-American War. I think a lot of immigrants did. They were basically, Mexico kind of had this loose grasp on California. Their government was not in the best shape at the time. They were just kind of, there's a lot of corruption, turmoil. California was kind of already in contention, and the Mexican-American War kicks off in 1846. It's a very, very small war. It is technically a war, but like, you know, it barely registers as a war. It's kind of funny how you can say the World War II, and it's like, well, that was a war. Yeah, that was a big war. It had huge ramifications all over the world. The Mexican-American War did not. I mean, maybe you could say because the U.S. got control of California, but not directly any major effect. This wasn't hundreds of people. It was a small-ish conflict. So after a year, James W. Marshall is discharged, and he returns back to Sutter's employment, Johann Sutter, the guy he's making all this furniture for. But then Marshall, he must have been noodling while he was at war and fighting. Maybe he talked to some people, you know. And he convinced Sutter that they should build a sawmill on the American River. You know, makes sense. There's going to be a lot of industry moving out here. You're going to need the wood. Sawmill's a great idea, right? So they both just thought it would be a good, profitable venture. You know, where you've got Sutter being, I suppose, kind of the money man. He also had like a large farm. And so he had some money, and this is like an investment opportunity for him. And so he goes along with Marshall's plan. So while they were working and setting up this sawmill, it seems like they were about done with the sawmill and, you know, starting to get to work. It is when Marshall was making his rounds, he looks into the water and he makes that discovery of gold. So this was January of 1848. And so he did take this discovery to Sutter, and they conducted tests to make sure it was really gold. First, they pounded a nugget with an anvil to prove it's malleable. Yeah, they knew that. Then they boiled the gold flakes in lye soap. And after that, they tested the nuggets with nitric acid, and gold doesn't respond at all to nitric acid. So any reaction from the acid would prove that other metals were mostly present, but nothing happened. It was really gold. After further testing, they believe it to be about 23 karat gold, or 96% pure. Isn't that kind of interesting that, you know, these guys weren't gold miners, right? They were building a sawmill. Sutter had a large plantation. But I just find it kind of funny that it's like, oh yeah, you know, if you want to make sure it's gold, you test it with nitric acid. Everybody's got nitric acid lying around, right? I thought that was kind of funny that, and it's interesting. That's what we consider common knowledge today is just constantly shifting, right? Which is why there's, you know, so many jokes about generations. I know I'm saying something kind of obvious, but you know, you compare just the youngest generation to the oldest generation alive today, and the gulf that exists between the two, it's just amazing the common knowledge, how much it changes over just decades. Whereas in centuries, a kid could probably spot different kinds of trees, and you know, they knew what things to avoid in the wild, and they just knew a lot more about the land back then. I just find that kind of fascinating. Anyway, enough of my little divergence there. So Sutter and Marshall tried to keep the discovery a secret, but by the spring of 1848, the word was getting out. In particular, some guy that apparently needs a lot of attention, a merchant in San Francisco, found out about this. about the gold. His name was Sam Brannan. He was such a loudmouth that his name goes down in history, apparently. But he started waving a bottle around in the streets of San Francisco that was filled with gold dust. And he's just waving it at people walking by, just saying, gold, it's gold from the American River, you know, trying to get everybody excited about it. Well, he might as well have been shooting off a starter pistol to start the rush to the river to find gold. Within days, half of the city of San Francisco had departed to the Coloma area to search for gold. This is not unlike hysteria. You know, it just sounds a little hysterical. I mean, geez, that's insane. Like, to just up and like, well, there's probably some gold. How shitty was it in San Francisco that they're like, ah, mate, I got a good job. But that's that FOMO, right? You start planting ideas in each other's head. And next thing you know, oh, they left. They said they weren't going to go look for the gold. Oh, man, what if they all get rich and I'm stuck back here being some, making linens or, I don't know, making stools or whatever. You know, they fear they're missing out. So half the town dumps out, probably all the men, you know. So we'll get back to Marshall and Sutter soon. But first, and the ramifications of this influx of people. But first, let's introduce the Murphy brothers, John and Daniel. These were two guys whose lives would forever be changed by the discovery of gold in California. And these were bold men. These were adventurous types. That's not to say that Marshall wasn't, but I get the idea that these Murphy guys were really just very outgoing and they really took chances, but they also seemed to be pretty methodical and smart about the way they went and did things. So in 1844, the Murphy family was part of a wagon train that was the first immigrant party to cross the Sierra Nevada into California. Back then, it was still controlled by Mexico. And the famous and tragic Donner Party actually took the same route the same year, but it took it too late in the year. And Martin Murphy, who is John and Daniel's father, was actually part of the party that helped rescue the Donner Party. You know, the Donner Party was famously stranded in the cold and had to resort to eating the dead. So they had to resort to cannibalism. Funny enough, I'm pretty sure I remember from hearing a story about one of the Murphys, or not Murphys, one of the Donners that survived actually opened up a butcher shop in San Francisco. From what I remember, I'm pretty sure that was the case. Maybe it wasn't one of the Donners, but one of the people in the party. I just don't know if I could eat that guy's meat that he's selling. I don't know if I'd trust him, but you know, you do what you got to do to survive, I guess. So John and Daniel Murphy, you know, they, when arriving in California, they made their way to San Jose, where one of the Murphy brothers, John, was asked to assist in operating a general store. And this offer came from Charles Weber. And this guy is somebody who the brothers had recently met in Sacramento. And apparently they got on really, really well. And they would basically be lifelong friends from here on out. He's kind of along in a lot of their schemes, but their businesses and their ventures. They'd worked well together. So then in 1846, the Murphys and Weber were directly involved in the Bear Flag Rebellion, which is kind of the part of this independence movement to make California independent from Mexico. So the Mexican-American War. And the rebellion took about a month that summer. So at the same time that Marshall's fighting, Bear Flag Rebellion, Murphy and Weber, they're also fighting. So far, everybody's fate's about the same, right? You've got the Murphys. They're coming over through Sierra Nevada on a wagon train. Marshall came over on a wagon train through Oregon. They both fought for California's independence. So as a result, after 25 days of California being its own independent nation, it was its own nation for 25 days, the U.S. Navy ships arrived and they basically claimed the territory for the United States. And there wasn't anything anybody could do about it. You know, the immigrants weren't going to fight it. You know, most of them wanted it to be part of the United States anyway, you'd think. So you flash forward to the summer of 1848 now. Okay, Marshall has discovered the gold. The news has gotten out. It's now, you know, you've got this influx of people coming from San Francisco. The news of the gold in the American River reaches the Murphy brothers. So they would stay in contact with Weber, but he would actually go on to found the city of Stockton the same year. And these families are really pretty famous, as you find out. So the Murphys, they arrive in an area east of Stockton, which is south of Coloma. They're a little way south of Coloma, but they set up a new mining operation there. They weren't the first to arrive in the area, but it sounds like the people that were already there was a very small, you know, probably not well-funded operation, you know, just a couple of yahoos with some pans, you know, walking around in the river, you know. But the Murphys seem to have a little bit of money coming over from Sierra Nevada. They just, I get the feeling that they were connected and these families had a little bit of money when they came to California, because they seemed to just kind of set up shop and get going, you know. You don't do that if you're completely destitute, right? So this area that they set up in, they put a trading post in this spot, and it would be a thriving trading post for a long time and actually would end up becoming a town, and the town would be named after these brothers, the Murphys. It's called Murphys, the town. So from here, the two brothers would start to make a lot of money from gold mining and also from their trading post. So either the Murphys were going to make money from the gold, or they were going to make money from selling to the gold prospectors, supplying them with tools and things like that. And this is kind of that old adage, you know, during a gold rush, sell shovels. Well, the Murphys kind of hedged their bets. This is where I say they were a little more methodical, in that they, you know, realized that, well, gold is a big risk, so we should hedge our bets. Let's set up a trading post. That will surely be successful in this area, because they know there's going to be an influx of gold prospectors, and they're all going to need to be supplied with food, tools, all kinds of things. So a trading post is a genius idea. It's a perfect idea. And then also they got Native Americans to do a lot of the gold mining for them. And I kind of wonder if the gold, I mean, eventually, obviously, the natives would start to realize the value, but they were able to, like, there were times during this that they were able to trade, really, you know, get a big chunk of gold from a Native American for like a blanket or something like that. So, you know, so they kind of had, you know, they were taking advantage of the Native Americans. Let's be honest. They were totally taking advantage of them, but they were paying them and getting them to work. I don't know. Like, we could judge everybody all day, but yeah, they, you know. I mean, a big successful business guy took advantage of somebody. Or is, who's surprised here? Nobody, right? I'm pretty sure you can't even make a large company without taking advantage of somebody. Anyway, I don't want to divert from the story, but, you know, I have thoughts about this. Okay, so meanwhile, quite a ways north in the Coloma area, things aren't going so well on the Sutter property. Since word got out about the gold that Marshall and Johann Sutter had found, they started having problems keeping workers at their sawmill. Well, if San Francisco's having problems keeping their entire population in place, you can imagine that right next to the river at the sawmill, it would have been impossible to keep employees, because they're all just going to want to be gold prospectors, you know? You need a little pan, head down to the river, you know, you get lucky and you could be set for years. You know, so that's kind of what they were thinking. They think that they're going to strike it rich. And so they all, you know, people just walk away, start panning for gold all around them. So this news spread to San Francisco, right, and the rest of California. And you've got people flocking to this area, particularly. Highest concentration of people are going to just descend upon this area. Well, this is where they said they found the gold, of course. And this is just bad timing for Johann Sutter. So, you know, you'd think he's been given a grant on the land that he's on for the sawmill in order to build his sawmill. You know, but the problem was that he was given this grant by the Mexican government in 1841. Well, the United States was taking control of the entire region. So the claim Sutter had on the land, I mean, they could have honored it in a way, right? Like, I mean, he was an immigrant. He had made claim to the he had sort of a legitimate claim to the land, but apparently it didn't have friends in high places, right? So he had no claim. And so people just walked onto his property, and even his other business ventures were kind of problematic too, because like you said, he had a large agricultural estate, which was known as New Helvetica. Must have been his favorite font or something. So unfortunately, this enterprise would also be a victim of the gold rush, with a literal rush of people descending upon the area. They had squatters everywhere, and they were destroying crops, killing his livestock, and polluting his rivers. You know, they're doing what people do. They're eating, pissing, and defecating. It's just like imagine like a herd of people coming through, a herd of FOMO crazed people that are looking to get rich quick. And the U.S. government, you know, they denied his claim on the land. So now you've got Johann Sutter and James W. Marshall. They had an advantage over people. They just didn't capitalize on it. I just don't quite understand. A lot of other people were able to make money gold mining, and these two had an entire first part of the year to get ahead of everybody, but they just weren't, I don't know, they thought they could keep it quiet. It's like they didn't realize how crazy things were going to get, you know? So they thought, well, we've got time to figure this out. We'll just keep it quiet. We'll slowly build an operation, you know, and make sure we can secure our rights. See, I think that was the thing, is he's trying to secure the rights to the area before he starts making this big gold mining operation. And, you know, so what ends up happening is that Sutter ends up selling all of his assets in the area, and he moved north to Yuba. And this seems like a really embittered guy. For the next 30 years, he petitioned the U.S. government for compensation for the gold discovery, you know, and try to do any great new business venture. He had tried his hand at gold mining a little bit at first, but it failed. It's kind of funny that guys that found the gold originally couldn't seem to strike it rich gold mining. So Sutter dies of a heart attack in 1880 without a penny of compensation from anybody. He's one of the guys, it was his land, kind of, that the that the gold was found on, and he basically died. You know, he didn't make any real wealth of any kind. You know, so as for James W. Marshall, his fate wasn't much better. He parted ways with Sutter and left the Coloma area after, you know, he sold all those assets off. So he bounced around California trying to find another big gold strike. But eventually he just had no success. He eventually settled back in the Coloma area and started a vineyard. It sounds like pretty decent business, but it was profitable for a while, but eventually he would kind of be driven out of business by competition, which is, you know, too bad, because it sounds like that would have been that's a nice business, you know. It's not gold prospecting. Maybe you're not going to get super rich, but, you know, that would have been a really nice way to, you know, say, you know what, I didn't get rich off the gold, but look what I have. I got a nice vineyard, but, well, shit. So Marshall, you know, he's forced to basically sell his vineyard. He's going out of business. But then he tries his hand at gold prospecting again, and he becomes a partner in a gold mine near Kelsey, California, throwing basically every bit of money at this project, you know, just going for broke. The mine failed, and he nearly went bankrupt in the process. So then Marshall ended up basically living out the rest of his days in Kelsey, earning a meager living. he made his money off a little garden. You know, nothing wrong with that. You know, but that's the funny thing. If he would have just not been chasing this FOMO, not had this fear of missing out, he probably would have lived a much happier life. Same with Sutter, right? But instead, they spent the rest of their lives embittered over what they missed out on. And so Marshall dies, and somehow, I'm still not quite sure who did this, but his body was taken back to Coloma, and a bronze statue was set up in commemoration of his gold discovery. I guess his body was actually buried in the spot where his vineyard was, so that was pretty nice. But unlike Marshall and Sutter, the Murphys got rich. Very rich. They were two of the most successful gold prospectors during the gold rush. Within a year of starting their 1848 mining operations, they'd made over $1.5 million, or roughly $40 million in today's dollars. And from there, you know, that was just the beginning of their career. I'm not going to go down into what they did in the 1850s or later, but they just kept being successful. I think they had a ranch. One of them might have had a ranch. They both got married. You know, it was pretty much a story of an American dream of the 19th century. And really, it just kind of emblematic of what everybody had hoped for themselves. They were the ones that ended up kind of winning out here. The FOMO was because of people like them. You know, they were so successful. So tens of millions of dollars worth of gold was extracted every year for several years during the California Gold Rush. And this is overall, not just the Murphys. It peaked at around 1851 with $81 million worth of gold being extracted. While it might have seemed like a bunch of people got rich, the truth were that there were so many people who rushed to California that it just kind of diluted their chances of getting rich. In fact, in 1848, the daily earnings for an individual miner dropped from about $20 a day in 1848 to less than $8 a day by 1851. I mean, neither one of those wages is bad, really. It's not bad for the time at all. However, the real winners of the California Gold Rush were the people like the Murphys that had hedged their bets. They had more capital to work with, too. You know, maybe their mining operation doesn't go so well for a little while, or they hit a dry spot where they got to keep mining, but they got to be able to pay people to mine. That's the problem. Miners get paid whether or not they find gold, right? So it's a high risk, high reward proposition. So to close out, I want to read from a handbill that might kind of put you in the headspace of what people were thinking about back in the, this would have been, I believe this was 1848 or 1849, I believe, is when this handbill was handed out. And a handbill is basically just like a paper advertisement. You know, it's got cool old Western fonts on it, you know, and the way they talk is kind of interesting. But this was basically trying to get people to emigrate to California by ship, and basically explaining what you could get paid. So here's the transcription. Do you want to go to California? If so, go and join the company who intend going out the middle of March or 1st of April next, under the charge of the California Emigration Society, in a first-rate clipper ship. And there's actually a big hand-drawn picture of a clipper ship right in the middle, right before it says, California, emigrate to California. So the society agreeing to find places for all those who wish it upon their arrival in San Francisco. The voyage will probably be made within a few months. Yeah, you said that. You said for middle of March or 1st of April next. I mean, we literally just read that. Anyway, the price of passage will be in the vicinity of $100, all written in capitals. Children in proportion. I think that means you can't be like... One one guy or gal with like 30 kids. I don't know if they were worried about trafficking. Probably they were more worried about just feeding children. So they didn't want a overabundance of children on the ship. So then it says, a number of families have already engaged passage. A suitable female nurse has been provided who will take charge of young ladies and children. Good physicians, both male and female, go in the ship. It is hoped a large number of females will go, as females are getting almost as good wages as males. Female nurses get $25 per week in board. So just to compare, remember now, they were getting, miners were getting $20 a day when they were mining in 1848, which is really good compared to this nurse. You know, they're making like, what, seven times more maybe. Anyway, even in 1851 or a few years later when it was only $8 a day, okay, that's still almost $50 a week, you know, $40, $50 a week, depending on how many days a week they work. Anyway, school teachers would get, $100 per month. Gardeners, $60 per month and board. Laborers, $4 to $5 per day. Bricklayers, $6 per day. Housekeepers, $50 per month. Farmers, $5 per day. Shoemakers, $4 per day. Men and women cooks, $40 to $60 per month and board. Miners are making from $3 to $12 per day. See, that's kind of interesting that they're saying the miners are making even less. I'm sure it varied quite a bit. I was going off of a average that I was giving when I said the 20, and that then it went down to $8. Anyway, so, and it says, female servants, $30 to $50 per month, and board. So some of these are pretty good deals. You could be a gardener, by the way, for $60 a month, and you get board. Like, you get to have a place to stay, which is great. That'd be my biggest concern, is having a place to stay and having a secure job when you get there, you know, because that's the scary thing. It's like, you get there, and what if there's no, everything's done based on somebody's word. Oh, yeah, it's a nice big town out there. It's really, you know, it's well settled, and there's all kinds of facilities and this and that. And then you get out there, and it's a shithole. But this wasn't the case, obviously. But anyway, so female servants, $30 to $50 per month, and board, washing $3 per dozen. Okay, I love that they're letting you know how much it costs to do your laundry. Masons, $3 per day. Carpenters, $5 per day. Engineers, $100 per month. And as the quartz crushing mills are getting into operation all through the country, engineers are very scarce. I like that they throw that in there. Like, engineers are $100 per month. We can't find any. They just throw that statement out there. I kind of like that. Blacksmiths, $90 and $100 per month and board. See, I've always thought if I was going to be dropped somewhere throughout history, almost any time, I'd want to be a blacksmith. Why? Because the blacksmith is very necessary. Everybody likes a blacksmith. Come on. They're building everything. You need them. Most importantly, you need them making the weapons, not using the weapons. So that's kind of where I, you know, oh, sorry, you guys go off to war. I'll be sure to make you some freaking swords or some shit back here. So, sorry, back to the handbill. Anyway, the above prices are copied from late papers printed in San Francisco, which can be seen at my office. Which they don't say who he is. I don't think he signs his name anywhere. He just says, my office. It's just kind of funny. Anyway, having views of some 30 cities throughout the state of California, I shall be happy to see all who will call at the office of the Society, 28 Joy's Building, Washington Street, Boston, and examine them. Parties residing out of the city by enclosing a stamp and sending to the office will receive a circular giving all the particulars of the voyage. As agents are wanted in every town and city of the New England states, postmasters or merchants acting as such will be allowed a certain commission on every person they get to join the company. Good references required. For further particulars, correspond or call at the Society's office, all in caps. So that's 28 Joy's Building, Washington Street, Boston, Massachusetts. And I was curious, so I looked up this Joy's Building, and I found a picture of it. And it kind of seems like one of these big buildings that had all kinds of businesses in it. It looks like a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Well, if you include the attic there, it's like a 5-story building. It's got all these chimneys coming out of it. It's this big square building with a whole bunch of windows lined up on the front, you know, with an angled roof. And it looks like there's a law office in there. There's Goodrich and Huntington. There's all these Wells & Co. A missionary is in there. A boot and shoe store in leather. There's a music academy in there. These are all on the signs written on the front of the building. It says military rooms on the side of the building. I don't know. It's kind of interesting. So anyway, that is our story for today. Not the most dramatic ending there, but from here though, next week, as I was trying to think through, okay, what would be a good place to go from here? And I thought about, okay, well, we could follow those wagon trains back east, and you know, then that's going to take us back in time, back to basically Benjamin Franklin. Shortly after the Revolutionary War, which we'll get back there at some point, but then I could have gone down into Mexico, made the connections there with California. I could have just covered the Bear Flag Rebellion, the Mexican-American War, but I ended up thinking about it some more, and I wanted to zero in on an aspect of this time period that's always kind of made me curious. And that is the influx of Chinese immigrants into California, into San Francisco. And one particular story stood out to me, and that was the story of Tai Lung Schultz. And so next week, I will be talking about her, as she is if you don't know her name, you should know her name. She's got a very interesting story. She very much stands out. I feel kind of bad that I didn't know who she was, or if I learned about her in school, I don't remember. You know, I just don't remember. So next week, we'll delve into her and some of the stuff that she did in San Francisco, as well as talking about just Chinese immigration in general in the 19th century and what that was like. And it's not good, I'll tell you that. It was rough for them. Definitely very rough, but we'll get into all of that next week. So anyway, if you haven't yet, subscribe to the podcast. Check out my newsletter at meridianspodcasts.substack.com. But for now, I'll see you next week. I'm Charlie Noble. Thanks for listening.